Now I would like to begin the more academic, it's kind of a shift, because the shift is we're going to be speaking about modernity. And of course, modernity may sometimes be seen as, I don't know, the contrast or whatever, the challenge to spirituality. So is modernity challenge to spirituality, or is modernity something that can enhance and liberate our spirituality in new ways? I know Bill yesterday spoke about the return of the mystic in the postmodern era. So maybe we can have that as a question on the table for us. I'd like to start out, and I think I have three remarks here at the beginning of my notes, and I think this may have come from Alon's original program for the conference about what we might speak of in terms of modernity, or maybe these are my own notes. I don't even remember. It probably doesn't matter. One of the things was gender, how to address the inequalities of the past in traditions. Secondly, hierarchy in traditions and authority and how that shifts in the modern period. And then shifts in authoritative knowledge, the sort of truth. Where do we find truth? Do we find truth in science? Do we find truth in religious tradition? Where is truth? Well, I'm of course going to be speaking of the impact modernity has had on authority within the Islamic tradition. And first, again, I'd like to start with a general framework, and then I'll talk about Islam specifically. The general framework would be some characteristics of modernity. And of course, one of the characteristics of modernity, or one of the ways of dating modernity, is what is known as the Enlightenment in European thought. And one of the characteristics of the Enlightenment is that reason becomes the main arbiter and standard for truth. Scientific method becomes the way that one approaches truth. And revelation becomes secondary, or of course in the face of increasing secularism, marginalized completely as a source of truth. A second characteristic of modernity generally is ever-increasing sense of history and historical change, what we might call slippage, you know, historical slippage, the gap between the way tradition presents itself and what we find. You know, we realize that tradition itself is located in history. Another, and that I have related, although this could be a separate point, people therefore began to examine tradition and specifically religious scriptures, and of course the main watershed in the West would be biblical criticism, the use of literary critical methods to look at the Bible in ways that it had not been looked before as a historical document. A third feature of modernity is a more political one, which would be the domination of the West, which more or less corresponds historically to the, you know, to the modern period, post-Enlightenment. The West becomes efficient, bureaucratic, powerful, and is able to dominate most of the world, Asia, Africa. And of course, Muslim countries are particularly affected by colonialism. You have, in the case of many Muslim societies, a gradual displacement of the Islamic sacred law. You have the challenge of Western culture more and more. And of course, the scientific rational outlook. Is it a Western outlook? Is it a kind of value-free method that applies to all? Those kind of questions circulate in modernity. Finally, I'd like to mention the characteristic of modernity, social change. I mean, of course, social change has gone on throughout history, but we have almost an exponential change in the last few maybe I could say the last 100, I don't know, should I say the last 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, you know, invention of the automobile to the internet, factories, rapid means of production, if you're a materialist, and one example of social change that impacts society and religion and tradition is, of course, the change in the family, which has even reached to the Muslim world, to India, to China, the nuclear family pattern, for example, spreads with modernity. With increased education, the social roles of women, of females, changes all over the world. Even in the Muslim world, many women are expecting higher education, expecting to work outside of the home. That's due to both their sense of increasing individuality, wanting, you know, sense of self-worth coming from some kind of activity outside the home, and often just an economic reality that families need two salaries to survive in many cases. And that causes a major shift. Oh, that actually wasn't the final point. There's one more point, which is the political change of modernity with the nation state. And again, the nation state kind of is on the same historical timeline as the Enlightenment. So people see their identity, and of course a word that circulates in the theory of modernity is identity, and a person's identity as part of a specific religious community has often been displaced by their identity as a citizen within a nation state, or at least complicated or enhanced or whatever we want to call it. And of course the nation state becomes the arbiter of law, and one can discuss the relationship between law and values, but certainly it becomes another player on the scene in all kinds of ways that separate modernity from the past. Now, somebody may say, why are we talking about modernity? Because we're all in post-modernity. And of course, that's contested. What is post-modernity? I don't think we have to obsess about that. Somebody asked me yesterday, when did post-modernity start? So I said in the 1980s, but I'm not completely sure about that. It's, of course, a theoretical construct, and I would define the difference with modernity. And, you know, let me relate it to Islam, because I really haven't said much about Islam lately or the Muslim world in this presentation. People used to talk about a certain kind of thought in Islam. I mean, people in the 20th century used to, Muslims sometimes talked about Islamic modernism, and people would even say, I'm an Islamic modernist. Well, now that title rings a little, you know, stale. And that's evidence of postmodernity, because you see, modernism was based on the confidence in human reason, you know, that this was going to change. Let's say at the beginning of the 1900s, people thought, you know, we're going to conquer all diseases. We're going to have inventions that will make life easy and beautiful for everyone. We're going to live in peace. We're all going to be calm and modern and rational. And of course, the world wars in Europe really shattered that vision in the West. And increasingly, these inventions that were supposed to free us often, you know, became a nightmare. So let's say an ecological disaster, or the atom bomb, or, you know, humanity sort of faced the fact that reason was not going to be this ultimate fix-it for the problems of the world. So that kind of lays part of the ground. And then really, you have, a fragmentation, a feeling that things are a human creation, but then do you have any ultimate truth at all? And so you have a kind of, on the one hand, maybe a postmodern vacuum of meaning, but you also have kind of an upside to postmodernism, which is a kind of celebration of our complexity and our globalism, and that our identities are not some kind of essential box that we have to stick to, but rather we can discover ourselves and work through those identities, because even those are not ultimate. So in postmodernity, we live in a world of globalization. We're interconnected in ways never possible before in terms of economic and information. We're pluralistic. We have contact with the other in ways that were never possible before. So, for example, you could say our meeting at this, you know, this seminar is a postmodern event in many ways. It's religiously and ethnically eclectic. It's also kind of theoretically eclectic. Sometimes we're not quite sure who we are and what we're doing. We have a little bit of music and a little bit of prayer and a, you know, little bit of talk, and that's kind of postmodern, if you see what I mean. We're not trying to establish one particular thing that we all have to assent to. I think I have three more points on postmodernity. You have what's called the shift in authoritative knowledge. And this is part of the crisis of authority, which is, of course, our theme. So, for example, in the Islamic tradition, there's a lot of talk about this specifically. So let me make it specifically to Islam. And there's kind of two threads here. The idea is, are Muslims today struggling to find religious authority? And why is this the case? And why are so many of the Islamic movements led by people who are not traditional religious scholars? They're led by doctors, engineers, because people today respect doctors and engineers. If you go to most Muslim societies and you ask the parents, what do you want your son, and maybe your daughter, but certainly your son to be, they'll rarely say a sheikh or a Sufi teacher, or, you know, they'll say we want him to be a doctor or an engineer. Of course, these are prestigious, they're well paid, and also people feel a doctor, an engineer, or a computer, you know, a software developer, or what's the other one? You know, sort of a list of lawyer. That was it. I was thinking lawyer, and it didn't come into my mind. Thank you. A lawyer. Those are it, right? Those are the four. And of course, in the Muslim world, then these people. Now, the other piece of that is that the lawyers and the doctors don't stick to what they're doing, but they become, you know, they start talking about religion, and. An explanation for that in the social science literature is the exponential increase of literacy in the Muslim world during the 20th century, with the nation states investing in mass, primary, high school, and subsidized university education. You have really, since the 1970s, you know, I mean, it started in the 20s, but it really is the 1970s where it's people expect to get university education. It's just like in America. You know, maybe not the same percentage, but basically most people now in the Muslim world are literate, at least in the Arab world. Pakistan, Afghanistan, countries with a low GNP, I mean, they lag behind in literacy, especially female literacy, but you still have, you know, exponential increases. But certainly in many parts of the Muslim world, it's kind of like some theorists compare it to the Protestant Reformation, where suddenly a tradition that had been, you know, the purview of religious experts, because they were the literate ones, and they were the ones who would read the religious texts, now this becomes an object of study and debate of the educated people. And with that shift in authoritative knowledge, everybody can jump into. Now, you could say, well, maybe the tradition itself didn't have controls. You know, you didn't have a sort of degree of Islamic scholar. Yes, you would go to the madrasa and you might study for 12 years or 20 years in the tradition, but it really took that public recognition of your authority rather than a specific ordination or stamp to determine that authority. So you have competing authorities today in terms of what Muslims should be doing and what the Quran says, and so on. Finally, postmodernism is marked by translocalism and transnationalism. Those are big words for migration. People are moving around, especially, this is again something for Muslims, Europe is changing. You go to Paris, I was just in Paris, right, or Brussels. You go to Paris now, Arabic is, you know, kind of a second language. It's really handy to know Arabic in Europe. In the United States, you have in Canada. Canada are now the Muslims are the second largest religion in Canada because of migration, and so that really changes things. And transnationalism works in terms of a circulation of ideas, circulation of capital, circulation of people in ways that was not possible in previous times. That's very postmodern. Okay. Let me make a point about the relationship of religious tradition to modernity. And this is just an idea to throw out. And actually, I'm influenced here by...
Your last point, so I don't have to bring it up, because I think you're giving such a marvelous introduction to postmodernity and modernity. Ethnicity, the rise of an emphasis upon ethnicity, do you think that that has some interesting connections with postmodernity as well?
I think the rise of ethnicity, if I understand it, or ethnicity politics, or identity politics, the way postmodern theorists, and of course, postmodern theorists live in America or Europe, right? So they see what's going on in their societies, where you have people coming from all around the world, and you have the phenomenon that some theorists call hybridity. You know, the sense that many people have multiple identities, and actually, we all have multiple identities, right? We all shift. So you have a shift in the sense of the self. And actually, but I get too many ideas at once. Sorry, I might go on a few tangents. I hope I can remember this idea. It's from a Canadian scholar of Islam, famous, called Wilfred Cantwell Smith. And he said, in the old days, everybody had a soul. So the way that the religious traditions talk about we persons in terms of our soul. In the modern period, the focus shifts to talking about the self. By the modern period, I mean the period of Freudianism and post-Freudianism. The 20th century, shall we say, people were concerned about the self and development of self and self-help. Nowadays, everybody's concerned about identity, but nobody quite knows what it is, because that tends to shift. The soul, you were trying to kind of fix it and develop it and transform it within a certain context. The self, of course, some would relate it to the soul, like the Jungians, and some, would try to make it a kind of modern rational self. But even then, I think even the Freudians would not claim that the self was totally rational, but they kind of wished it would be. But identity is something that everybody's looking for. And sometimes people take what I might say the lowest common denominator, the easy route, might be ethnic identity or actually, unfortunately, religious identity. And if I can say something, this might have come up later, but since it's coming now, let her rip. This is related to this. I was thinking of this, the remarks by... The rabbi yesterday, the ecological New Age rabbi, David was his name? Was that right? And he was talking about identity and sort of, if I can say, Jewish identity being bound up with the land as kind of a modern phenomenon and as something that can get in the way of spirituality. Well, I would say in the case of Muslims, the parallel would be, in the modern period, Islam becomes the identity. So you get this whole discourse about Islam is a total system, Islamic identity. In other words, the way I put it, nowadays, many young Muslims or many movement participants in Islamic movements are worshiping Islam. They're not worshiping God. Everybody's talking about Islam. They're not talking about God anymore. So that's identity. That's where identity can go. It can become a sort of something to hold on to. So rather than holding on to God, you're holding on to your identity because you feel that everything's slipping away. And of course, that's a feature of postmodernity, because multiple identity is not like the soul or the self that is a fixed kind of thing. Does that kind of...
Yes, and I was thinking also of a characteristic of modernity, I think, is oftentimes said to be a stress upon the universal human rights, universal truths, philosophical systems which try to embrace all reality and wrap it up and so on. And for example, I think an example in the churches would be, say, the ecumenical movement, you know, coming at the time of the Second Vatican Council in the 60s. We were optimistic that we could overcome our differences, say, Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox, and we could, you know, arrive at the eschaton and so on, the millennium. And now the post-ecumenical period, where we're all reasserting the specificity and particularity of Roman Catholicism, of the Armenians, of the Byzantines, of the Russians, of the this, of the that, and so on. And I would suspect also that so the stress upon, people talk about how difficult the ecumenical thing is and so on, you know, and we were kind of naive and whatnot. But see, I would read this as kind of a postmodern stress upon refinding the particular and making sure that the particular, the different, as we say, doesn't get swallowed up in some abstract universal thing. And I would suspect that something similar happens when you say people are, so that would kind of correspond with your idea, people are worshiping Islam rather than Allah. In Catholicism, people worshiping Roman Catholicism in a certain sense rather than the Trinitarian God and so on. And I would suspect also, though, that ethnicity, you know, I am Yemeni, I am Arabic, I am Pakistani, they may not say this, but I would suspect the ethnic factor also is subtly entwined. And so, you know, and this gets like sinews, very thickly intermeshed with religion, too. And sometimes there's a kind of ambiguity as to where the religion ends and the culture and all that sort of stuff, too.
If we're going on that thread, and again, I'm speaking on the wing here, so I may not have it totally formulated. But first of all, a corresponding trend to the ecumenicalism in the church would be what we have in American culture in terms of how immigration is perceived. You may be familiar that the old metaphor was the melting pot. All the immigrants come to America and they get kind of, you know, assimilated, digested, or they get put in the melting pot and they all come out like the cookie-cutter American. And of course, the reality is recognized that, you know, I don't know, it's a mosaic, it's a salad bowl, you know, that the metaphors change and people celebrate, you know, their identity. But in the case of Muslims, I'm thinking right now that it is a little bit different than what you're suggesting, because this idea of sort of one total Islam that's the same everywhere is very dominant in the more literalist movement Islamic discourse. So I would portray the Sufis as being the ones who allowed at least individual diversity. But you do have actually in many Islamic movements a rejection of cultural specificity. So sort of saying those practices are Pakistani or those practices are, you know, not established by the tradition. So you almost have a kind of anti cultural trend. At least it's like Muslims aren't so much, Muslims may actually be acting according to particularities, but theoretically are not yet celebrating them, except there is a certain celebration of post-modernity by Muslim intellectuals in the West who feel that the pluralism of post-modernity liberates them to be Muslims. You know, that sort of anti-hegemonic or anti-essentialism. And so, of course, you have a discussion in terms of religion. There's a certain dis-ease with the ideas of postmodernism because postmodernism rejects essentialism. Essentially, the characteristic of most religion, of, I don't know if I should say most, all, you know, tradition tends to be essentialistic. This is the way things are. You know, the ideal is an essential ideal. Postmodernism wants to deconstruct, wants to take apart tradition and say this is specific to a certain historical group at a certain time. So one could see it as being anti-religious, except in terms of a mystical, individual, particularistic strand in religion. So Sufis might be able to, you know, mesh with postmodernism perhaps more than some others within the tradition, you know, and God knows better. But maybe I'll make a move on a little bit here. What I was going to introduce was just an idea, and I think it's actually on the same theme that we were just talking about. The idea of talking about tradition and modernity. The Enlightenment metaphor, of course, Enlightenment is like shining a light, right? Shining a light. So you had sort of the idea of the light of reason shining into the corners of superstition, myth, and irrationality, and illuminating them, and perhaps tradition ultimately fading away or going away in the glare of this light. And one scholar called Daniel Brown has suggested that perhaps we could shift that metaphor a bit and think of the light as the light of, I don't know, modernity, light of enlightenment, I'm not sure, as shining through the prism of tradition and kind of being refracted out in different rays. So that it's really not that tradition is going to be minimalized or limited by enlightenment or displaced by enlightenment, but rather it's going to be complicated, come out in beautiful different colors, that rather than one essential ray, something like that. Now, I was going to say something about types, impact of modernity on religious authority in Islam. Well, I already talked about what you might say is the dispersal. You know, it's funny, you could, what word you use matters. So I could say the kind of dispersal of religious authority. I talked about the engineer and doctor specialists in Islam, people like Abul Ala Maududi, who was a journalist. Even Sayyid Qutb, of course, they had good Islamic knowledge, but they weren't sort of in the authoritative position or having the insignia, shall we say, of being a sheikh or a traditional religious scholar, but their voices are very dominant in the current Islamic scene. So you have that, and you have a number of strands in contemporary Islamic thought. To make it very simple, I'll use ideal types. You have liberals, we already mentioned. You have literalists or fundamentalists, Islamists. You have nationalists, people like Ataturk in Turkey or Abdel Nasser in Egypt or Reza Shah Pahlavi in Iran, leaders of the 20th century of the modern period who try to replace the identity of Islam in their... nationalism is we're Turks. You know, we're Turks first and Muslims second, or we're Iranians first. So you have things symbolically like taking away the Islamic calendar or taking the Arabic script, you know, in the case of Turkey. And see, do you get the idea? You know, some Turkish Muslims would say, you know, this is kind of the enemy of Islam, and others would be maybe a little more neutral on that, but say at least it's certainly stressing ethnic identity, a national citizenship in a nation state and a shared history rather than the shared history of being a Muslim. So you had some of those movements which have largely faded, you know, in this scene. Those movements rose you know, in the 1920s and kind of went on until the 1960s and maybe in a certain sense didn't deliver. But nationalism at one level didn't deliver as an ideology. However, I think nationalism has succeeded as a reality on the ground in terms of the fact that Muslims, wherever they're living, I think are very aware of themselves as citizens of particular nation states and act within those nation states. See, the opposite or the sort of, you know, other face or whatever you want to call it, contrast to nationalism is what we call pan-Islamism. Muslims of the world unite. Let's have a universal Islamic movement that will unite people under the banner of their Muslim identity. And those, certainly there are such movements, and some of the political Islamic movements do have an international reach. But on the ground, it's very difficult to organize across borders. I mean, you could say, well, you have the internet and you have information. That can circulate across borders. But political organization, forming networks and so on, to be effective, usually has to work within nation states. At least that's what the theorists say, you know, and God knows better. So there's those kind of movements. Now, in terms of literalism and modernism in the modern period, I'm going to quickly list some of the characteristics of the more literalist or Islamic movements so you get a sense of what those are. Maybe I could name a few if you're not familiar. By the way, okay, so the characteristics of the Islamist or the literalist movements: religious literalism, taking the Quran and Hadith as literally as possible, not encouraging looking at the classical tradition of interpretation. Secondly, the appeal for an Islamic state. The idea that Islam is a total system and it can only be implemented within the context of a political order that privileges it and implements it in all areas of life. Third, there is often an anti-Western tone to these movements and a sort of attempt to distinguish between what is modern and rational and desirable and effective and what is Western culture seeping in. And sometimes it's very difficult to distinguish those two. And I mentioned in a previous lecture that although you might think that these movements are conservative in every area, they can sometimes be quite innovative in terms of, for example, ijtihad. And a case would be after the Iranian Revolution, trying to establish an Islamic state in Iran, clearly you had to make all kinds of new rules, because previously the Shia theory had said that you couldn't even have a legitimate state. After the revolution, you have an attempt to construct a legitimate Islamic state. That's clearly a major ijtihad. So conservatives are not always, you know, they're not necessarily traditional. Literalists are not necessarily traditional or more traditional. And you know that we have to make that point. Sometimes the word traditional or traditionalist is misused. You have many traditional Muslims in the world who are following Islam, you know, the way that their group followed it and their parents followed it and so on. They're traditional Muslims. It's not an ideology for them. It's not like an agenda that Islam has to be a certain way. It's just the way we kind of think of pre-modern religion. You know, it's like everything reflects tradition, the way your house is arranged, the way you deal with people. I suppose Islam, of all the traditions, seems to be the one that's most successfully resistant to modernity in the West, in the sense that there still is that tradition and traditional practice, at least in some parts of the Muslim world, although it's quickly, shall we say, under the assault of modernity. And of course, we can take different positions on that. We can lament the loss of that traditional beauty. You know. But on the other hand, one might become romantic and unrealistic in terms of that lament. So we have some scholars in the West, Muslim scholars, who call themselves traditionalists, people such as Syed Hussein Nasser, who say that, you know, sort of traditional Islam was the most ecological and, you know, the most kind of integrated of all traditions. And of course, all traditions would probably make that claim that they were, you know, had this coherent worldview. And of course, that's what happened with the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, the shattering of that coherent worldview. So the problematic is, should we try to go back and recover that coherent worldview, that's being a traditionalist, or is that project romantic and, you know, whatever, and we have to live within the spiritual parameters of modernity and post-modernity? That's sort of a philosophical question.
I have a sense that that religious authority was compromised, the notion of religious authority was compromised, and the notion of religious tradition was compromised by Freud himself. Freud, Sigmund Freud, who dissected the notion of God and considered God and called God and the soul. Well, God, he considered God an infantile projection. That God is an infantile projection, that God the Father is, we are all children looking for the Father, and the notion of God is, that's it. God's been dissected into just that. And the soul does not exist, as we know it, as mystics look for it, as religious, as those who seek the mystic experience, and that the mystic experience is a mental illness. And I think that is, that really, to me, the postmodern threat or problem or challenge to religion and religious authority has to do with that notion. So, what do you think?
Well, the way I guess I have a mic and I'm talking, I'm sure everyone has ideas and maybe we can have a shared discussion on that. But a word that came into my mind as you were posing that question was, funnily enough, the word humanism. And I'm kind of thinking of humanism because, of course, one of the features of early 20th century thought, and I'm thinking of both Freud and Durkheim, as in some ways thinkers in the West whose ideas just kind of became common wisdom. You know, like even somebody who's not an intellectual. And by the way, I think this is related to one of Alon's questions for the whole seminar, which is